Hi, this is Favi Fav.
And this is Babelito.
And we are
Latinos Who Lunch,
the podcast where we talk about important things like
beep, 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 beep.
Hello, hello, hello.
Kasho, kasho, kasho.
How's it going, Babs?
Wired. How are you?
Oh, the opposite of that. Lethargic.
¿Por qué tanta flojera?
I don't know. It's already noon and I forgot to eat. Like, I just been busy all morning. Am I a skinny legend now? Am I one of those white girls that's like, oh my god, I forgot to eat? No, I've been so busy this morning working on stuff that I just realized when I sat down to record that I didn't eat anything.
So that's your lunch story of the day. What do you have for lunch? Nada.
Nothing. I didn't eat shit.
Wow. Yeah, you're becoming one of those people. I sometimes don't have time to eat, but you better believe that I always remember that I didn't eat or that I need to eat. But, oh, you know.
Okay, what'd you have today? What'd you lunch on, honey?
So, like, I went to go get a test because I do it, like, every other week or whatever just to be sure. And it's so easy to get tested here.
But you can eat STDs anything or for...
So what? No way, pues por el COVID.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
Yes. But we, you cannot eat anything before because it's the saliva, you know?
Yeah.
So I just had a banana with me and then I came back and I, my husband made it's called German cake. I don't know what it is. Google it. But it was
German
fucking delicious.
German cake or just German cake?
No, it's German pancake.
Ooh.
So it's like you pour like a pancake batter in a como en un sartén and you put it in the oven y se infla todo way. And we just fill it out with caramelized apples. So I had a slice of that with cream cheese and raspberry jam. And a cappuccino, of course. That's why like I'm all sugared out. You know, like in the morning I have to have sugar. Like sugar and fat, like cream. Like I need half and half.
Yeah, you say it every week. Yes, we know.
I do. Ahead. It's just because like I'm not, yo no soy de postres, pero en la mañana, like all the sugar I can take, you know?
Yo no sé de postres, pero todas las mañanas me como un pedazo de banana bread, un plátano, a German pancake.
Unos conflays.
Un conflays, my soro. Like, oh my God,
my
girl.
My soro. I haven't heard that in fucking decade.
You know, that's what my family calls cereal, just in general, my Mexican side, because son norteños.
My soro?
So they just call any cereal my soro. Like, it doesn't matter what it is. It's always my soro.
I didn't
know that it wasn't the name for cereal until I was an adult.
Wow.
I didn't realize it was like a brand, you know?
Yeah, it is a brand. I haven't heard that since I was a kid, probably.
Yeah, well, if you wouldn't have offended my grandmother by opening her fridge, she probably would have offered you some my soto if you were hungry.
Never forget. Never forget. What are you working on? Why are you so busy?
Oh, I did the installation for Museo del Barrio, and that's going up already. And now I'm planning another one for this hotel in Indianapolis.
Wow.
I'm helping produce an art festival. I'm doing two podcasts. I just bought a Nintendo Switch.
You did?
Oh, girl. I was just like, last week, I was just reflecting and like, I never do anything for myself, you know?
Right.
Like, I'm always like working, working, working. And finally, I was like, I need to just say I'm going to have one day off and do nothing. And
right.
For years, since I've been in high school, I stopped playing video games because I love playing video games. And it would just take up my whole day if I played video games. And I just wanted to be more productive even then. And so I'm like, you know what? I'm going to buy a fucking Switch because I fucking love Mario Kart and Smash Brothers. And I'm going to play it on the weekends, like on my day. I'm going to force myself to take a day off Sunday. So I'm announcing it here so the world can hear it.
Porque no me chinguen, puntos.
No me chinguen los domingos, okay? I'm trying to have a nice, peaceful Sunday. I don't want emails. I don't want fucking Zoom meetings, bitch. I know I'm saying that, and I probably have a meeting scheduled this Sunday, but
I'm just
going to start to set that boundary, okay? Because can I have one fucking day to myself where I don't have to talk about something about, oh my God, about art or about, I don't know. I'm just like so overwhelmed with shit. And I feel like the pandemic has totally fucked with people's boundaries where people are always texting me like, hey, do I have time for a call? I'm like, bitch, it's 10 p.m. What are you talking about? I don't want to talk about anything right now. I'm literally trying to get high and watch WandaVision. Bitch, by the way, have you heard about WandaVision?
I've heard of it, but I haven't watched it. Tell
you
me all
know
about it.
What, bitch? You know, I'm not like a superheroes like nerd, but... I just been hearing about it all the time, and bitch, in the first 5 minutes of the first episode, I was fucking hooked because I'm a TV nerd, you know.
Yes.
And every episode of WandaVision is referencing American sitcoms, so I'm not gonna give it away because there's some twists in there in this show. And I don't know, the only thing I know about the Marvel Universe is Black Panther, you know? So yeah. That's the only reference I have because I haven't seen any other fucking superhero movie. Oh, I saw the first Spider-Man, so I know that. Oh, and I saw the cartoon one. With
just viste la de cartoon, yeah, me acuerdo.
And those,
so
those are
it.
The three that I've seen. And anyway... So that's like my limited knowledge, right? Is X-Men Marvel? I don't know. Ooh, don't hate me. Sorry. I take it back. Erase it. Anyway, I don't know. I don't know anything. See? So anyways, I know that WandaVision, Wanda and Vision, which are the two like Marvel people in this show, are part of the Avengers somehow. Something about Ultron. That's what I've gleaned. I don't know anything. But... Okay, so the first episode is set in like a 1950s television show. So Orale. It's like a conglomeration of like Leave It to Beaver, I Love Lucy,
oh
and like,
to Beaver.
Like, yeah, like Bewitched, the Andy Griffith Show. Like, it's a recreation of the sets. Like, the house is very recognizable. And then the next episode, I was like, wait. It's still black and white, and I'm like, something's happening. The set's different. The hairdos are a little different. I'm like, oh, my God, it's the Dick Van Dyke Show and, like, Honeymooners, Mary Tyler Moore. Like, it's – as the season goes on, the set – every episode moves forward a decade in television history.
Oh, my God.
So then by the 90s – it's like it's shot. The episode is shot like Malcolm in the Middle. It's so good.
Wow.
It's so good. I was geeking out. And now I'm at like episode 8 and it's like Buffy the Vampire Slayer slash like Harry Potter. Like that's the way that it's like, you know, visually the way that it looks like. It's so good.
And this is on Hulu?
This is on Disney Plus, honey.
Oh, I don't have that.
Me neither. But when there's a will, there's a way, honey.
True, true.
Anyway, I've been enjoying that. All that to say,
leave
yes.
Justin Favela alone.
No, I thank you so much for everybody that's always trying to work with me. Like, hello, I'm so blessed to have so much work. But I just want one day off, you know, to play video games and watch TV. That's it. That's it. Wepa, wepa. Okay. Have you been watching anything?
Yes, I started watching I've rewatched two animes because I have my family visiting, my husband's family, and we watch the Demon Slayer all over again. I'm obsessed with that anime. But we started watching one called The Devilman Crybaby. Ugh. It is the most fucked up animation. It's so good. It's this director. I don't have the name with me. Maybe like And when we come back from the interview, I'll tell you more about it. But like all of his anime, the movies and series are fucking insane. They're so good. Actually, he's the one who directed Get Your Hands Off of Isaacin. But this one is twisted, man. There's some crazy... I don't even know how to explain it. It's just like this like kid who becomes this devil who kills other devils on Earth. And it sounds so simple, but you gotta watch it. It's so, so good. And I think it came out a couple years ago. But anything that he makes... He also did this animation called the Ping Pong, the animation. And it's just like the most beautiful, twisted, strange animation that I've seen. It's so flat. The faces are like melting in all the scenes, but it's just so refreshing to see. So that's what I that's what I've been watching. Just same, like at night I try to disconnect and I try not to have my phone with me, so because I still get emails, because I have students this semester, dude. I have students in Chile, I have students in India, we're gonna have a guest speaker from South Africa. Like, it's so amazing, but it's like there's like no boundaries anymore, which is great, but it also requires that you're answering emails from students who are just waking up, you know, like, yeah. and things like that. So it's, I know exactly what you're saying. It's a little tough, but it's also the same. It's just like, when would I imagine to have like this artist or this student, you know, in my classes? So, but I tried the same, tried to get, you know, fumar un poquito y ver pendejadas en la televisión. I gotta disconnect. If I don't disconnect, I'm gonna go crazy.
I know. I took my email app off of my phone. So I only check emails when I'm on my computer. And if I don't answer them by the time I'm off of it in the evening, sorry.
That's it. But today we're here because I...
Ooh, what a flawless segue. Go ahead.
Beautiful, right? because I've been wanting to do this for a while, and because we're ending, you know, like the podcast... I wanted to just make sure to interview some of the people that I most admire in my field, and also some of the people that have been supporting us and also supporting me in the last 5 years. So this is the first out of 4 interviews with some badass women of U.S. art history. And we're starting with Shayna Klein. She was my grad. She was one of my fellow grad students in UNM. And I remember we used to sit on the corner and just complain about all the readings that we have to do. And she is now an amazing scholar. And she's one of a handful of white people that has been interviewed in this podcast. But it's worth it, obviously, because she's amazing. And she's come out with an incredible book. We talk all about it. And I want you to listen to it and tell me, because this is all about politics and food. It's so fucking good. So why don't we listen to her interview, and then we'll come back with maybe final recommendations.
All right. OMG, Babs. You know what I'm going to talk about, right?
Dímelo todo.
The Latinos Who Lunch coloring book, now available at latinoswholunch.com/coloring book.
Yes, you can get your copy at the Writer's Block in Las Vegas. Or again, as Fabi mentioned, you can also get it through our website. And this is your opportunity. They're running out, and there's no better chance than today to get 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 copies. Las que quieran, pero cómprenlo ya, cabrones.
Okay.
Hello, everyone. Babelito here, talking to you from sunny old Santa Fe. Why am I here in Santa Fe, not Albuquerque? I don't know. Ask Airbnb. Anyway, here I am with one of my favorite people in the world. I am so, 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 so excited. I've known this person since 2007. We are old. And we have Shayna Klein, who is talking to us from where?
So I'm in very chilly Cleveland. And by the way, we are old, but we're pretty good looking given our age. Like, I don't think people know how old or young we really are.
I think I tell people in the podcast how old I am because of my hair.
Stop it.
Girl, I just started getting into essential oils. So like at night,
I put rosemary oil. I wake up in the morning and I like drink some lemon oil. It's changing my life. But anyway.
So funny. You know, I just really quickly started a skincare routine because I was like, oh man, like I feel like I'm so behind on like wrinkle creams. I've never used anything. So now I'm like all about trying to preserve whatever youthfulness I have left.
Yes, I feel exactly the same way. My conversation with my friends are now like, oh, what are you listening to? Or like, what podcasts are going on in your life? Or it's like, oh, so what creams are you using? Tell me more about those. Tell me about those oils. Did I tell you about my back? Okay, well, Shane and I went to the University of New Mexico. We went to grad school. I have the most fun memories because we took a class, I was in several classes, but one class on race and gender with our advisor, Kirsten Pye Buick. Kirsten, I know you're listening to this. Come to the podcast already before it ends. Come on.
Yeah, seriously.
And I just remember you and I will sit in a corner. We will complain about the readings. We'll be like, did you finish the readings? And I didn't want to admit. I think I only admitted it to you. I will be like, no, like that's so, like it's like 300 pages. Like I'm not gonna do this. And you're like, okay, me neither. So like I always felt good, but fast forward many years and now you have your book. So amazing, congratulations. We'll talk about the book, but I want you to introduce yourself, where you at, where you teach, everything that you do.
Yeah, so I just published this book called The Fruits of Empire. It came out of my dissertation from the University of New Mexico. And since then, I've had a number of fellowships. I have landed in an assistant professor position at Kent State University outside of Cleveland. And I hope that when you read this book, Emma, it reminded you of UNM, because I really feel like this manuscript is actually like a love letter to our program at the University of New Mexico, like to all of the coursework in Central American art history that the late David Craven taught us, to our mama bear, Kirsten Buick, who's like pioneering in the field of African American art. And, you know, even to those really special classes that we had with Aaron Fry, who, I don't know if you remember this, he took us to his home, right?
That day I was so stupid. I was asked to volunteer in Marfa, and because back then like I was drinking the Kool-Aid, I'm like, I'm gonna go to Marfa.
I remember that. You were so into that.
Yes. I was all about that minimalist art, baby.
Oh, well, I don't want to give you FOMO, but it was like the most meaningful experience. He took us to his home on the Laguna Pueblo, and he like took us to the church, and he had like a talk with the priest on the site. It was like my first real contact with like a Native American reservation. And it was just like so open about it. And it's these kinds of experiences that I feel like made our program so special. Like I am so proud to come from UNM as opposed to some of my peers who come from like the Ivy Leagues or the brand name institutions. Like they don't have the kind of knowledge and coursework that we had.
Right. And actually I just took a seminar on how to go up the ethics of being in a search committee, right? And as part of the ethics, and I don't know how of a official rule this is, they tell you that you, in order to avoid class discrimination, you shouldn't consider somebody specifically from the program they come from, because this country is infamous. The university system of this country is infamous for choosing people from the program they come from as opposed to the actual individual and what they have to teach. So I feel like after this summer, slowly things are changing. And now people like, they appreciate a lot at the University of New Mexico, where before, if we were to go against somebody from Harvard or Yale, like, No chance.
Right. Like, I think it's so great that we're from kind of like a West Coast school where we had this really rigorous curriculum in both everything inside the canon and then our professors telling us to explode that canon, right? Or like invent new canons, you know? Like, a lot of my peers didn't have that kind of education. And so they're like really behind when it comes to the current cultural climate. Like, they're just starting to realize like, oh, I have like an internal bias, or, oh, I've been teaching European art. Like they haven't been thinking about this for years like we have. And that's not to say that I don't still constantly make mistakes, or that, you know, I have blunders and that I'm like, you know, so woke. Like I hate that word woke even, but you know, I think that we're just really lucky that we had such a unique education.
Absolutely. Yes. And I it's so interesting because when I go present in art history conferences, I bring some of the ideas that we've been talking about for what, 13 years, 14 yeah. years? And people are like, what? What was that? And she's like, oh, that was Kirsten.
What? There's Baroque in Mexico? What?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So before we continue, before we get into the book, what have you been eating? Like what, either like tell me what you ate today. Okay, no, let's do this. Tell me what you ate today, but also like maybe like a special meal that you've been doing at home during quarantining. I don't know, yeah. Like, go ahead.
So my answer is really embarrassing. I feel like because people think of me as a food studies scholar and an art historian who's like always thinking about food and contemplating it, I should be this great cook or a baker in the kitchen, and I'm so not. Like, I actually have the palate of a five-year-old. I live the plainest, most straightforward foods. Like, before we talked, I had slices of apple with peanut butter. Like, that's how rudimentary.
Amen.
So.
You gotta get that protein somehow.
Exactly. I can't claim any sort of sophistication in the kitchen, but, you know, since doing research on food, I feel like my choices have become more ethical. Like, I try to buy organic when I can, even though a lot of organic food is still produced by like Dole and Chiquita and like a lot of these problematic corporations. And I definitely still don't eat a ton of meat, just like thinking about how meat is produced in this country. And, you know, that I don't place any judgment on people who do. Like, I'm not preachy about it. You know, I'm not trying to like be evangelical about it, but... I definitely think more consciously about what I'm eating. And it's also easy for me because what I eat is like kindergarten food. So
where we're at. Speaking of Kirsten Cho, we said that she's like, I have the palate of a 12-year-old, but she cooks some mean Asian food. She just made us some Chinese food. Oh, yeah.
Before she got off Instagram, she was like photographing her food. And then what really made me jealous is, don't you guys every year go to Puebla? Or where do you go?
Yes, with Puebla, yeah.
Yeah, you guys would like photograph your food, post it on social media, and I would just be like torn apart at home, dying to eat what you're eating. Like that food looks so amazing.
I was that hipster that every time I went out of town, like I'd picture all of my food. That was actually one of the few things I miss of social media, because I will eat something and I will be like, this is so beautiful. Even today, like I just made like a romantic dinner, you know, for my hobby, and okay. I made lamb, which I haven't made in maybe 10 years.
Wow.
And it looks so good, and it tasted so good. Yeah. And I keep taking those pictures, but they're just for my camera. So you best believe that my camera is filled with landscape pictures and food right. pictures. It's so sad.
Well, I think about that a lot. Like, what is it in the 21st century that we suddenly want to photograph our food? Like, that really wasn't a trend. Until the rise of social media, the rise of the selfie. Like, there's something about photographing our food that it's not for ourselves, right? It's for other people. And so what is that impulse, and like, when did it originate?
Yes. Okay, let's get into that. But before we get into that, let's talk about, oh my God, I feel like this is, your family's gonna come back and we are just like in the middle of the conversation. Okay, so here I have your book, The Fruits of Empire, Art, Food, and the Politics of Race in the Age of American Expansion. Woo!
Yeah, it's a mouthful.
This is an amazing book. Like, there's so many themes that you touch upon that I want to get into, but of course, we don't have time. But ideas of how the history of the production of food in this country, how it embraces and disavows new territories, peoples, of how the expansion of the United States, it's always contingent to like a visual culture of some sort. And the history of the production of food, it's no exception. So how do you attach a group of people that have not been part of the country? It is through promotion of food, et cetera, and the consumption of food and the production of it and images. Food promotes stereotypes. Food promotes the creation, again, of the nation. Yeah. And I wanted to talk to you about how food is throughout history has become part of its protest. But I have a couple of questions.
Sure.
But before those questions, I want you to tell me a little bit more about not only the book, but how you structure it, because it was very specific how you structured the different chapters of the book.
Yeah, so it's loosely chronological, but really it's divided by specific fruit. So I have chapters. One is on the grape, the orange, the watermelon, the banana, and the pineapple. And I felt like as I continued to inventory all of these representations of food from the late 19th and the early 20th century, a lot of these fruits kept coming up again and again. And these were the fruits that seemed to be some of the most political foods, the ones that seemed to be the most racially charged, politically loaded, and ones that I couldn't ignore. And so it made most sense to structure the book around each individual fruit history and how it's represented in art and beyond, and like cookbooks and trade cards and photographs. It's really like a material culture study of food, more so than just like the capital A art, you know, painting and sculpture.
Right. Why the grape?
Yeah, why the grape? The grape is actually the most frequent fruit in still life representations that I found. Like, Americans were obsessed with grapes. They were always depicting them in still life paintings and beyond. And the grape was really rooted in a history of European cultural supremacy, that Americans wanted to elevate themselves to the ranks of Italy and Germany and France, these grape growing empires. And so by depicting grape culture in America, they were trying to insert themselves as these authorities of taste and sophistication. And so the grape was like really this food that could establish status for American artists.
Are there any Catholic, I mean, it's a Protestant country, but are there any like Christian iconography in relation to the fruit in how it migrates to the United States? And just to give our audiences some sort of context, we're talking about 18th century or so, no?
We're talking about like 19th century, yeah, like the 1800s, early 1900s, right around the time when like what we know of today as Napa Valley is coming to be. And so I look at the California, it's like loaded in Christian iconography, especially because so many of the paintings of California grape harken back to this nostalgic idea of Spanish California with missionaries coming in. And of course, what those images don't tell you is how they're relying on enslaved indigenous people, stealing land from indigenous people and from also Mexican landowners. And just like the sheer history of violence that is totally written outside the picture plane of this like romantic idea of the Spanish California grape.
You know, we just had an interview with an author who talks about the history of El Zorro and how the history of El Zorro, in a way, it's like it's the history of a renegade, like Robin Hood type of figure from Mexico, perhaps from somewhere else, because it's kind of like a mystery. But how in the early 20th century, the nostalgia of anything Spanish related to California and Hollywood, the Spanishization, if you want to call it, of California, renders the architecture, the movie industry into this like Spanish. And by Spanish, I mean the country, Spanish paradise.
Right.
But I never thought about the food because the food is complementary to that. To this day, you go to the missions that were constructed in the 18th century in California, and each mission claims that they have the first like grape orchard.
Right, totally. Yeah, so actually that's how meaningful grapes were. Like Junipero Serra, the, you know, ultimate conqueror, he comes to California and one of the first things he does is installs vineyards next to these California mission churches, right? So that cultivating the land and creating vineyards on the land was a way of claiming that landscape. It was a way of stealing that land, changing it, modifying it, dominating nature, and was really this device for political power. And at the same time that like Spanish California becomes so romanticized and whitewashed in Hollywood, remember there's also like a ton of racism against Spanish descendants. And so it's just this mixed bag of, you know, racial hostilities.
You know, it's interesting of that you talk about the grape because the mission system in California was created inspired by the mission system in Mexico in the 16th century, because the 16th century mission system of the Franciscans was considered the golden age, right, of the mission system. So the later missions constructed in Arizona, Texas, et cetera, they look back into the 16th century. And those Franciscans in Mexico were bringing Mediterranean plants, right, from Spain to create this idea of Jerusalem, because that was the idea, the second coming of Christ, and then they were going to construct the new Jerusalem. So I wondered if there's anything of that when it comes to California in the 18th and 19th century. And it seems like maybe the introduction to the grape has a little bit to do of creating a Mediterranean, and it's a little bit of a Mediterranean weather, but a Mediterranean environment landscape, you know, through the food.
You know, I hadn't really considered that. So this might be an unsatisfying answer because I like don't know too much about that history. But in terms of the California grape, it definitely has to do with California seeing itself as the American Mediterranean. I mean, this is the grape that they use, the American Italy, the American Mediterranean. And I hope that part of this book will inspire scholars to look at grape culture in New Mexico, in Texas, around the time period of colonization and later, because there's like so much history to be done here. And visual representations of the fruit were just as ubiquitous and just as pervasive as discussions about the fruit itself. So visual images are such an important part of analyzing this history, and it needs to go way beyond California.
Right. And also our the culture of wine consumption, right? That it's attached to class.
Totally. Yeah. And so like even as late as the 1970s, there was this huge competition in which California wines won over French wines. And like everyone was so upset because France is supposed to be the leader in wine. And here comes California unseating France in this competition. And it's just so loaded, right? We think of wine consumption as being part of like the elite classes. And so that's definitely rooted in earlier 19th century belief systems too.
Oh my God, have you seen that movie, A Walk in the Clouds? I just thought of it.
No, I'm going to write that down.
A Walk in the Clouds, it's a movie by, I think it's Alfonso Cuarón.
Okay.
One a Mexican filmmaker, but it's with Johnny Depp and some Chicanos. I don't remember. Right. I'm so bad. Like I should be crucified because I know the name of the white actor, but not the Chicano actors. But it's about a family, like a California family that have had this orchard for a long, long, long time. But there's like a love story and like it's ridiculous. But it's all about the grape.
Okay, I gotta look that up.
Okay, so we have grape, bananas. Let's talk about bananas.
Yeah, the banana is really complicated. The banana is what actually was the inspiration for this book that we learned about in our Central American art history class. That's where we were exposed to the artwork of Moises Barrios. He's a contemporary artist in Guatemala. I don't know if you remember studying him, but what he does is he goes around and paints the display windows of Banana Republic clothing stores in the United States to think about how we glamorize and romanticize Banana Republic, a word itself that is just like so racially loaded and prejudiced. And that this system has created so much political instability, environmental devastation. It has started wars. And so the banana is like one of our most political fruits that has created so much bloodshed over that fruit and the land in which it was grown. And so I look at the visual culture of the banana since the 1800s. And I also use that as an example of how important it is to study art and representations of fruit, because in the United States, the banana was not mainstream until like the early 1900s. And so oftentimes most people would encounter the banana in an image before they would have ever held one or tasted one. And so I'm always trying to advocate for more people to study the visual image just because it's like the point of contact for a lot of people and food.
Speaking of visual image, the cover of your book has an illustration, a painting that is a bunch of bananas, and then you have like it looks like U.S. war jets like on top of it. Can you tell me a little bit more about the cover and the art?
Yeah, I love that cover. That too is by Moises Barrios. Like that's how important Barrios is to my project, because I can give you so many examples of how images of food are just racist and awful and terrible. But it is way more rewarding for me to show you examples of how artists were resisting those systems of oppression. And so Barrios is a great example because he shows how devastating banana histories have been in Central America and the Caribbean. And so he shows that handful of bananas with American fighter jets defending those bananas like they're landscapes to be protected and of U.S. interest and to be profited from. And so his artwork really shows how we as Americans have historically been so entangled in land colonization and commercial conquest as it comes to the banana. And I'll just tell you, for you know, listeners who might not be familiar, I mean, the United Fruit Company, which made the banana mainstream for American consumers, they orchestrated a coup that was supported by the CIA in Central American countries like Guatemala. So like, that just shows you how political the fruit is, that, you know, there were wars that have been fought over the importation of this fruit and controlling the places where the fruit is grown.
That's, like earlier in the year when we had the storming of the Capitol by those white supremacists.
Right.
Somebody said like, this is not called a coup just because it's not like in a Latin American country or in a
stable. Use the word banana republic. Like a senator talked about, you know, what has America become? This, we're not a banana republic. I mean,
wow.
This term, first of all, and second of all, I mean, it's a term that also is really insulting to Americans because they're the ones who were trying to intervene in Latin America in terrible ways in the first place, you know?
And another aspect of this whole history is you talk about how the images are cues of where your diet may go, right? Because that's just the way that the empire is going. But also, like, I think my husband and I recently saw this thing about how there were all these kinds of bananas. Yes. And then the companies chose one specific easy to grow banana, right. And now there's all this like problems with it where like that we're not gonna be able. Speaking of, like, I have one here. I eat like two bananas a day, and like that's gonna go away. But it's not. If I want to buy something like this, I don't know, in 15 years or something, like I'm gonna have to pay a lot of money for that.
Yeah, so let me be a bummer for a second.
No!
I know, I hate to break to you. There is like a lot of hysteria around the fate of the banana. There have been articles and books written about it since the 2000s because our banana variety is, I think, asexual. And so it is hard to reproduce. And we've set up this monoculture in which we've relied and depended on this one variety of the banana. And so when it gets hit by a virus, it affects all its type. And so I don't know what the destiny of the banana is going to be. There's been a lot of hysteria over it for a while now, and nothing's really happened, it doesn't seem. So maybe we have reason to be optimistic. I'm not sure. But also, to be a bummer, the banana that we eat today is a lot less delicious, apparently, right, than the banana that was eaten in the 1800s. Like, I would love to eat the Gros Michel banana that Americans had. It was shorter. It was thicker. Kind of pudgier, and it was supposed to be like so flavorful. So
you still can. I think you can order it, but it's gonna be like
$50. It comes from like India now. Yeah, I think it's hard to get for people in the United States, but I would pay big money to try a Gros Michel banana. Like, that's where I want to spend my money.
Note to self, Christmas present.
Right.
Birthday present.
I mean, I welcome it.
Okay, so we've done grapes, bananas. I love how this is developing. Let's talk about the watermelon. The watermelon is probably, in terms of our popular culture, the most visually charged fruit. Tell us a little bit more about that history.
Yeah, so my watermelon chapter is definitely my darkest chapter. It was the most depressing chapter to write, just because I can chronicle the visual history of the watermelon as this terrible racial trope for such a long time throughout American history. And there are so many examples of how image makers and artists used watermelon to portray this really nasty stereotype that African-American people have this insatiable lust for the fruit. Like, they are drooling over the fruit, stealing the fruit. So it perpetuates this really horrific stereotype. And a lot of scholars have located that stereotype in the 20th century, but it happens way before then. It happens around the Reconstruction period and the Jim Crow era, when African-American people have gained more rights as citizens. And what these images are designed to do is to show them as not good citizens, right? To show them savage, as animalistic, not even as human, as a way to try to advocate for taking away those rights. And so, you know, I had a lot of ethical dilemma in reproducing some of those images in my chapter. And I'm curious what you think about that in terms of like, what do you do in the classroom when you have really miserable images that confront, you know, ugly histories? I don't want to perpetuate those stereotypes, obviously. I want to confront them, but I also am sensitive to how maybe my readers of color might feel upon seeing these images. Like, do you have to straddle that boundary in your own research?
Yes, I actually, the very first class I taught at University of New Mexico, my thesis project was in the Inquisition. So I have all these images of violence in relation to the Inquisition in Mexico and violence against Native Americans of Central Mexico, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know how, but the way I thought was very offensive to one of my Native kids.
Wow.
And she came forward and confronted me. She goes, "I think it's disgusting that you romanticize."
Oh my goodness.
I never did that. However, it made me rethink of the ways in which I teach this material because it's such sensitive, some sensitive material with good reason, and it's loaded with so much violent history. And that's the thing, like all the images that I show in my class in relation to the colonial period, they're violent.
Yeah.
Any image of the Virgen de Guadalupe, right? With this in the background, like there's a violent history behind it. But there's certain images that superficially look a lot more violent than ideologically, right? Or they're both equally charged. And some images don't look like that to our eyes. So it made me rethink of the ways in which I approach this material. So ever since then, from day one to the last day, I remind my students, one, that everything related to the colonial period, regardless of how beautiful it might look to our eyes, it's charged with this fucked up violence and ideological, you know, weight. So I think that doing this throughout the course allows my students to see that if I arrive to an image that it's visually just like strikingly violent, allows them to see that I am not romanticizing, you know, but it's a lot of labor.
Right. So that's also what I teach too, that a lot of the most racist images you can interpret as being like hauntingly beautiful, right? That's how they seduce you. That's how the danger of these racist images is that they use visual techniques of like beauty and seduction to try to make that claim seem real, to try to naturalize those stereotypes. And so I feel like I can't not confront these watermelon images. We need to be educated about them. I'm surprised by how many people don't know about the watermelon trope, and it hasn't died. Like, it keeps reoccurring as more people of color come into power. Like, it had a resurgence with Obama. I'm now seeing a resurgence in watermelon racist imagery with Kamala Harris in office. Like, Jesus. It's going away. So we have to know its history to be able to try to exterminate it.
And that's the thing, speaking of Kirsten, I think that's the difference. Like, we understand that, right? Like, she talks about how, like, we understand that these things are wrong, that these things are racist. But going to the core of that, even though it shouldn't be the labor of people because, you know, because life and because of a lot of things, I think it's worth into exploring some of these ideas. And I really do think that starting through the visual culture to the history of art will allow you to understand this in an easier way than going directly into some like heavy theory.
Right.
You know, like
because, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I think also our students are more prepared to deal with visual images than any generation before.
Yes.
We have Instagram, Facebook, Snapchat, billboards that are, you know, everywhere in terms of like how we use visual platforms. And so they are a uniquely visual generation. And so it's a great entry point to understanding how systems of power work, because they know that visual images can be deceitful, that they are manipulated, they are crafted very carefully by those who produce them. And so it's not even that mind-blowing for them to understand that these visual images were concocted and manufactured, you know what I mean?
Right, yeah, and that's the thing about teaching today. This is why sometimes I teach and then I insert a video and then PowerPoint. It's just, you have to be managing images in such a frantic way. Yeah. And that sticks to the new generations, because that's exactly how they consume them in Instagram. Speaking of, let's go back to that idea that you brought in the beginning of the interview. I look at some of these still lifes, and then you mentioned our obsession with picturing everything that we eat. What kind of relation do you see right there?
In terms of what it means for us today, or?
Uh-huh. Or both, like what it meant to have a fancy still life in the late 1800s or early 1800s, late 1700s versus show like flexing on Instagram, you know, like the delicious dish that you just ate.
Yeah, I mean, it was like a visual flex in the 19th century. If you had a beautiful still life painting in your dining room that showed the most mouth-watering, delicious fruits, that was a testament to your affluence, right? That was a symbol of your power, your kind of economic wealth. But it's funny because I also have read a lot of etiquette manuals from the time period. And a lot of these authors say, don't get a still life that looks too delicious. Because then when people come over and eat with you in your dining room, you don't want them to be envious of the still life painting, wishing that they could eat the foods in the painting more so than the foods that you've prepared on your table.
Oh, wow.
I know, isn't that hilarious? Like, you don't want your pictures to look too mouthwatering. It has to be this fine balance of being a symbol of status and wealth without outshining what you've actually made for your friends and family.
Oh, wow. That's so interesting. It's so ridiculous at the same time.
I mean, also what I love about the Victorian period is that that's when you have these individualized silverware utensils that come out. Like everything that you can think of, from a specialized watermelon knife to an ice cream spoon to a banana pedestal. Like all of these individual utensils come out in the late 19th century as Americans are starting to make more of a ritual around the consumption of food. And like really kind of cool artifacts from that time period.
That's fascinating. I wondered if you can send me some of those photographs and maybe we can post them either in Patreon or something so people, absolutely, so some of our viewers can see them.
Yeah, totally.
Okay, so I want to talk a little bit, and this is maybe self-serving, but I don't care. This is my podcast. I can do whatever the fuck I want. I've been thinking on captivity narratives of the 19th century, this paranoia of Native American culture and how it's going to get your women and it's going to get your children. And I tie it to like earlier in the 18th century in Mexico and those martyr portraits that you've seen that I talk about, and then later with Westerns, et cetera, et cetera. But I wondered a little, if you can tell me a little bit more about the Homestead Act, the idea of manifest destiny moving towards the West, because that history is contingent to this new territory the United States just gained with the Mexican-American War. But how does food play in the expansion, in the promotion of the West, but also in the disavowing of Native Americans and also Mexicans?
Yeah, so food is so immersed in rhetoric about the Western frontier. I mean, it's almost like obvious. It's so textbook. So think of like images of the 1800s when you have heroicized pioneers like Daniel Boone, you know, pointing their finger to the landscape that they want to conquer. That stuff enters into representations of food too, like we talked about with the grape. The idea that when you cultivate a piece of land, when you plant something on that land, you claim it as your own, and you're modifying that landscape and profiting off it for yourself. And so there's all this rhetoric, narratives in manuals and books and paintings and artworks that are suggesting that one way to take advantage of this landscape that was supposedly divinely bestowed upon white American people was to plant on it, was to make on it. And so representations of food look so much like landscape paintings of manifest destiny that created this idea that white Americans were divinely entitled to what was indigenous land.
And it's so interesting because you do talk about how it divinely entitled to cultivate food desecrate a piece of land that was sacred to Native Americans for you know, in a lot of examples.
And like to even go beyond that, not everyone was divinely bestowed this land, because the people who actually made the food on that landscape were not accepted as citizens. So the grape is another example of that. Also the Hawaiian pineapple. There was a lot of anxieties about the Asian immigrants and the African-American people, as well as indigenous Hawaiians who were harvesting a lot of our tropical fruits. White Americans expressed a lot of anxiety, saying that we don't want people of color making our fruit. Like, they shouldn't have the privilege to cultivate America's fruit lands. And so at the same time, they wanted to incorporate the landscape. A lot of them didn't want to incorporate the people who were toiling that landscape.
Wow.
Yeah.
One way or another, it's all contaminated. Let's talk a little bit about the pineapple. It's fascinating. I use the pineapple in my class, but to illustrate much earlier history. Okay. In the 16th century, you have the first, you know, Spanish, I don't know why we call them conquistadors. Like, they're not conquering anything. You know, it's not a romantic narrative. It's so stupid. You have the first 16th century invaders, they are looking at everything they've never seen before. There's one chronicler, his name is Fernandez de Oviedo, and his chronicles, nobody paid attention to them because he didn't know how to draw in the style of the Renaissance, naturalistically. He was like a bad artist. Sure. So he will have an image of a fruit and then talk about what it was. And it's very interesting because in his diary, he spent like 5 pages talking about the pineapple. In regards to the thistle, it looks like this, but it's not that. It might be an artichoke, but it doesn't really taste like an artichoke. 5 pages, girl.
Yeah,
5 pages trying to describe. So I always use that example to talk about if the Spanish were not capable of describing something as simple as like a different fruit, imagine understanding the more complex ideas of Aztec religion. Not to give them the benefit of the doubt, but just to add another layer to nuance with another layer of how the encounter, you know, again, also a term that I'm starting to not use as much, how the encounter is contingent to all of that, not only to the difference and the color of the skin of the people they encounter, but the different clothing and the different territories and the different foods. And that's just in the 16th century. But I know that throughout, since that point, since Oviedo, the pineapple became the symbol of status. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it has its own history.
Yeah, so in your time period, I would imagine botanical engravings are also a good example for examining that history. Mm-hmm. Botanical engravings are so rooted in a history of empire. Like you're describing, you have these amateur artists who are sketching the pineapple or fruits that they've never seen before. And they even show the fruits sliced in half to give European viewers back home the sense of what the fruit looked like on the inside. And to be able to describe not just what it looked like, but the taste would obviously be very challenging. Yeah. I mean, we tell our students, it's really hard to describe what you see, but imagine trying to describe what you taste. Like, you have to use a point of reference. And so the apple might have been that comparable point of reference for understanding what a pineapple tasted like. Mm. Pineapple is like one of the most imperial fruits. I mean, it has always represented empire. And even the shape of the pineapple, right? It has a crown. So it is like by nature a kind of food that lends itself to status and power and royalty. What is really crazy that happens in the 20th century is that there becomes this burgeoning and successful pineapple business in Hawaii. But the pineapple is not indigenous to Hawaii. That really surprises a lot of my students, mm-hmm. readers, because we think of it as so synonymous with tropical Hawaii, but that was imported from South America.
Right.
And it also shows you how visual images can make something seem so natural and can make the fruit seem indigenous to a place like Hawaii when it was not at all.
That's what Kirsten always talks about in terms of landscape, that we take landscape as a given, that it's so naturalized that it looks boring to us and we ignore it.
Right.
Yeah. And fruit is this, and like food is the same, is the same thing.
Yeah. But
we don't even think about it. We're like, yes, of course, like Hawaii, pineapples. When we went to Hawaii, we went and we saw an incredible exhibition, and I think we told you about. And this was like in early 2019 at the Bishop Museum.
Oh,
and
yeah,
it was the I mean, I know you hate that word, but it was the wokest exhibition I've seen in my life. Like, it was, you will have the visual culture of pineapple in Hawaii, but every single label was divided in two, a white label and a black label.
Awesome.
The white label will say the pineapple is a symbol of the economic prosperity of Hawaii, and it will be like a traveling magazine from the early 20th century, right? And then the black label will be like, by the way, did you know that the pineapple is not even from Hawaii? Like, why are you all drinking this like pineapple Kool-Aid? Like,
totally.
It was amazing.
I have a million things to say because, first of all, some of the best scholarship right now is coming out of Hawaii. Like, forget about your...
Yes.
Of the world, like the most like powerful and scholarship of resistance, in my opinion, is coming out of Hawaii.
Yes.
The second thing I want to say is that you're right. Like, we look at a landscape image and it seems so boring and it seems so straightforward, but we have to constantly unlearn, right? Mm-hmm. The process of unlearning what we see and what we know. And so much of my book is trying to expose how representations of food are not so innocent. They're not so innocuous as they seem. But also that we have to read what has been written outside of the picture plane, that we can't just look at what is being visualized, but we always have to look at who is being omitted, who is being obscured, what kind of histories are being glossed over in these images, because what is not pictured is just as important as what is pictured.
Right, and I think I think about, and coming back to the pineapple and what you're saying of what's been omitted, there's such a scientific weight to the pineapple because ever since the 16th century, and then with the advent of the Enlightenment and scientific re-exploration into the Americas, there was this, there's all these treatises that talk about weather, right? Peoples in warm weather were not allowed to think as people in cold weather.
Right.
So now, like, I'm just making these connections right now. The food, something like the pineapple, must have been an example, like this wild fruit must have been an example of something that is sensual, but like it's at the same time it's vacuous, right? Like, I don't know, like I'm thinking about the way that the way that native peoples from the late 1500s to this day have been disregarded in relation to weather, and now I'm thinking about food.
So that's described as climate theory. I deal with that a lot in my book, because with something like the banana, for instance, I mean, there are so many racist discussions and descriptions of how people in the tropics eat the banana, that they are part of these equatorial climates in which they are so lazy. All they have to do is pluck the fruit off the tree and eat it. There's no sophistication to people in the tropics.
Right.
The people being closer to the equator were thought to be less sophisticated, less intelligent. And then that's why I think a lot of Americans in the United States around the same time period, they're trying to distance themselves from how people in the tropics eat the banana. So they create all these new silverware tools and all of these new decorative objects in order to eat the banana and cook the banana, and not just to eat it raw in a quote lazy fashion. It's really just a way of distancing themselves from how people of cultures outside their own eat it.
You know, we read this essay on the picturesque and traveling in the picturesque is Mexico by Persephone. Ah, I'm missing the last name. But she talks about how trauma functions in terms of traveling. You have a perceived idea about, let's say, Mexico, like this exotic and fantasy about Mexico. And when you travel, the governments of the places where you travel from and the government of the places where you go feed into this fantasy. So they create maps to guide you through areas of Mexico City where you fulfill your Frida fantasy or your Aztec fantasy or whatever, right? But the second you cross that threshold, the second you go to a quote unquote not so safe neighborhood, and something may happen to you, which will end up in CNN and Fox News, you know, that when you cross that threshold, the sensuality, the attractiveness of that fantasy becomes trauma. And it's so interesting that you talk about food, because food does, it gives us these preconceived ideas. And I always think about Hawaii, because you go with this tropical fantasy pineapple thing about Hawaii, you arrive to Hawaii, and then you see all these independent movements, all these like native Hawaiians were like, fuck you tourists. So like you cross that threshold from fantasy to trauma. And but the vehicle that in a way, it's a nice liminal safe space between both, between the fantasy, the anxiety, it's the food.
Yeah, Emma, that is so brilliant, like the way you just described that, because you're right. Food is at that threshold that you're describing, because it is something that is tasty looking, delicious. It's something that's attractive. It can allow people to experience another culture without having to, be a part of that culture, I guess. At the same time, there's also this idea of you are what you eat, that since the colonial period, people in the United States have this idea that what you eat will transform you, both your racial composition, your moral character, that in the 1800s, it was dangerous to eat certain foods because they didn't want to turn into, say, like slow, lazy Native Americans, according to those stereotypes. They didn't turn into the people who were eating those foods because, food was so entangled in racist attitudes. And so, like you're saying, it's at that threshold. It can allow people to experience other cultures, but not too deep into that culture. A lot of people didn't want to, sink into that culture too much by actually consuming the foods in a kind of physical way, consuming that culture. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's like the difference between eating it and being it, you know?
Yeah, that is totally brilliant. The difference between eating it and being it, exactly.
Yeah, and it's interesting because now, like, after reading your book, and I'm changing my syllabus now because we have a whole, a seminar on encounters. And I never thought about food as a mediator for encounters.
Or
like a pre-encounter, right? And again, not understanding encounters like this uneven exchange of power. But it's so fascinating because I really never, again, because it's such a given, because we didn't think about it, because we're just, in the podcast, just one last thought. We do talk a lot about, we have been talking a lot about food, but it's always in relation to expectations of authenticity. And this idea that you have as this modern US person, you have an idea of what a Mexican taco should look and taste like, right? Because you saw it in TV, because you grew up with it, because of the stereotypes, because of everything. And the second you eat it and it's not, doesn't fulfill that fantasy of your own fantasies, it doesn't authenticate you, then you keep looking and then you label something as not authentic, you know?
Yeah.
And so like every time I see the word authentic in Mexican restaurants or anywhere, authentic Indian food or authentic this, I'm always like red light.
Right. Kirsten has always attuned us to the difficulties of that word, right? Like the speciality that comes with the word authenticity. But tell me what you think of this example that I heard recently on NPR. They were talking about how a lot of senators, create legislation and they leave the Capitol building, they'll go to like these two favorite haunts. One is a Mexican food joint and another is a falafel place. So isn't it interesting that some of these senators, they are doing that point of contact, right? They're having that encounter like you're describing. They're eating falafel, they're eating Middle Eastern food, they're eating Mexican food, yet they're also creating legislation that totally disempowers and discriminates against the people whose food that belongs to or was invented by, you know? And so food only goes so far, right? It can be this point of contact, but it only goes so far as to actually change minds or change attitudes. That as much as it can celebrate a culture and can bring people together, it can also, not be so helpful.
Right. Ooh,
We talked a lot. Like,
I feel like we're just getting started. But before we go, like, I know you have to go. Like, before we go, I want you to tell me a little bit of what's next. I know, like, this book has been in the works for years, right? And you're probably not thinking about your next project, but I wondered if you're working on something new. And also, tell us where we can find you, the social media, all of that stuff.
Okay, well, really quickly about this current book, I just want people to know that I'm not making a cent from the book. All of the royalties are being donated to the Coalition of Immokalee Farm Workers. It's this amazing civil rights organization that helps to ensure better wages for our farm workers and to ensure that the conditions are okay and, you know, to fight for people who are experiencing abuses on our fields. So that is where all of the money is going. My book is an academic book in some way, so that it's priced like one. Unfortunately, it's a little bit expensive. So I'd love to offer anyone a discount code to be able to make it more affordable. So I can give you that discount code. In terms of what I'm thinking about in the future, I still want to stay in the arena of food studies. Mm-hmm. I really like this niche that I found with combining art and food. And so the next project I'm going to tackle is milk.
Oh, yes. I was going to ask you about milk.
Yeah, because you know, it's not just any milk. It's breast milk, which is strange and quirky. But I'm telling you, I really think I'm onto something, because there are these really strange photographs from the Victorian period of women facing the camera while they're breastfeeding. And in the Victorian period, when it was impolite to even show your elbows or your ankles, right? You're so buttoned up in American Victorian culture. You know, why are women baring their breasts? Why are they breastfeeding for the camera? I'm really interested in ideas about whiteness and milk and motherhood. And so if anyone has any feedback or images, do send them my way. I think this will be my next project.
Yes, I think, you can take that back, because in Catholic, in Christianity,
right.
I look into this and I need another lifetime to do this project, but there is a relationship between the Dominicans, this religious group, and the Franciscans. The Franciscans attach themselves to the blood of Christ. So the Dominicans come out with the iconography of the milk of Mary.
Right.
Yeah. So they have this
competition.
Yeah, they have this competition. And recently there's been a band. Their name is Kings of Leon. And the dad of the singer, it has ties with the KKK. In the last album, you see all of their faces emerging from milk.
No. Oh my God, that is so fucked up. Yeah, I remember we've talked about this before and you pointed me to some images that are like so wild for maybe American eyes today. It's literally like the Madonna and child, but the Madonna has like milk spraying out into the viewer. I mean, it's so straightforward. It would never happen in American culture because we're so mechanical, but you're right. Like, there's definitely a longer European history that Americans are borrowing from in terms of the religious iconography behind milk.
And that's a thing, like, that's one of the things that I'm exploring, that the definitions of American as an empire, in so many ways, they're rooted to to Spain, like the Iberian Peninsula as empire. Like, I always want to blame the Spanish for absolutely everything, right? For all the shit in the world.
Right. They were responsible for a lot of it.
So I'm always attaching them to this fucked up history. Okay, so tell us your, tell us where everybody can find you.
Yeah, people can find me on Instagram. I have an account called The Fruits of Empire. And around once a week, I post an image of a food and art and I explain it or I offer interpretation. You can also just Google me. I have an academic profile page that's linked with Kent State University. I'm going to be giving a talk at Washington University in St. Louis in March. I have some other virtual talks coming up. And I've done a few podcast interviews now, but this by far was my favorite and the most. I can't wait to broadcast it.
Well, Shayna, my love, I am so happy we got to do this. I don't know, like, just thinking about some of those days in the classroom with Kirsten and then the second I got your book, I wanted to cry. I was so happy. I will be violently promote you everywhere I can. You're so sweet. I really hope, and I'm gonna show the image again for like those who get to see the Zoom recording. The Fruits of Empire, Art, Food, and the Politics of Race in the Age of American Expansion by Shayna Klein. Google it, Loca. It's everywhere. Thank you so much for this amazing interview. And yes, and we'll hopefully this shit ends soon so you can come to Mexico or we can go over there or something.
Thanks for your support, Emma. I love you.
I love you too.
That's us. Bye.
Bye.
And we're back.
¿Qué tal?
Yo, I cannot wait to read this book. Bitch, you know. Actually, you don't know because I haven't talked to you about it. I'm doing a whole show where I'm making a giant still life this fall based on our historical paintings. So I can't wait. This is like so on the nose. I cannot wait to dive into this book and do even more research. And from a scholar that we know, oh my gosh, Shayna, shout out. I do remember when we met in Washington, D.C.
Yes.
That was really cool to get a little tour of the Smithsonian's from her. But I'm so, let me tell you, Babs, I'm doing this. It's loosely based on Sandra Cisneros' books, this installation that I'm doing. Then also art historical images painted of fruit in Latin America, but then also for Estamos Bien, the show that I'm in New York at the Museo del Barrio.
Yes,
I did a mural, but on top of that, I also painted this really detailed replica Francisco Oyer's Plátanos Amarillos painting. I'm just so excited to get into this book, and I'm so happy to get Shayna's history and perspective on all of this.
It's amazing, and as we mentioned in the interview, the chapters are separated according to fruits. So the history, like the fucked up history of the banana, and you know, like the visual culture of the banana, the visual culture of the grape.
Yeah.
And there's so much to unpack. It was so good. I got the book maybe a couple of weeks ago. And I changed my syllabus in my class because we don't think about the class that I'm teaching right now, this seminar. It's a graduate seminar. It's called Art of the Encounters. So we're talking about how we're problematizing the idea of encounter and how encounter is about one society meeting another society, or one group meeting another group, or the one-on-one encounter, which is like a more philosophical thing that we get into. But in the class, we're thinking about the things that mediate that encounter. So before, like, all the Europeans arrive to the Americas, they already have preconceived ideas of Native Americans because they've seen images, because they've seen objects. So we're looking at all of those, that material and visual culture that mediates that encounter. But I never thought about food. And I mean, think about it, just like the way the Europeans were consuming chocolate and how they already give you a perspective of what you're like, the exotic lands you're going to encounter, but also the fruit, but also the pineapple, but also like there's so many different things. And that still happens today, that you have this idea of another culture based on your local, you know, like quote unquote ethnic restaurant. And when you arrive to that country, you sort of want an extension of what you already know, right? But I just never thought about food as like one of the, if not the most important mediator in encountering other peoples, you know, like it's so, so good. And as I mentioned before, like, I don't know, like Shayna was a breath of fresh air for me in grad school. She obviously studied with Kirsten, who's also going to be here in the podcast finally. Kirsten Pye Buick from the University of New Mexico, who's my mentor. And it shows. Her work is fantastic, fantastic, fantastic. I'm glad you liked the interview.
Oh my gosh, she's the coolest. I can't wait. I hopefully I get to talk to her in the future. And I'm sure her book is going to inspire many artworks, let me tell you, because just from your conversation, I really like what you guys are talking about, grapes, and because I feel like that's also something like Mexicans do, is having like grapevines in their backyard, you know? Like, we don't think about it, but especially in the Southwest, this like Tuscan, like Italian vibe in everybody's houses. It's so interesting how it's so ingrained in our culture to think that that's classy, you know?
Right.
And it all ties to that. It all ties to our perception of, you know, what is higher class, including fruit, which is so wild, especially when it comes. I never thought about pineapples as like jungle food. And you know what's so funny is on our Patreon last week, we talked about I went in depth about Survivor. And basically, you guys were talking about the same thing I was talking about.
Oh, wow.
Where there's not many people of color on the show because I think that the producers think that white Americans will perceive the people of color as having an advantage because
wild by nature.
Yeah, because they're wild by nature. And then so like the pineapple being perceived as this like this fruit that wild savages eat, I thought was really interesting because I don't now the pineapple, I think after like the 1950s, pineapple upside down cakes and Mai Tais and, you know, Dole Whip, all this shit. Like it's now like a tropical, like fancy fruit, you know?
You know, when I didn't talk about this, but when you go to Hawaii, when you go to Oahu, Honolulu, there's like a Dole plantation and it's like a mini, mini pineapple Disneyland. And they whitewash everything about all these people coming in and finding this virgin and fertile land. And as you say, like after the 1950s, there's like this ingrained ideas about pineapples in the United States and we use it for everything, but it really is about statehood of Hawaii and how it just became a whole entire thing. I mean, I feel like people can go on and on and on, and she really anchors it to race and gender, race and gender and class ideas to the United States. But like, I can imagine already a book like this in Latin America in terms of the avocado, for instance, or the lime, or there's so many different things. That was one, like low key, I almost wanted to do something like that because there's not a lot of food art historians that dedicate their work to Latin America. And Madalena, my friend who's been in the podcast, Madalena Salazar, she always talks about it. And remember, we mentioned a little bit when it comes to like foods that were very common in like slave plantations and how you see them in Veracruz, you see them in the south of the United States. There's just so much to unpack when it comes to food, you know? So this is like a beautiful introduction to some of those ideas. So again, Shayna, thank you so much. I'm so happy that you're able to do this. I love you, girl, and I can't wait to see you when all this shit is over. But anyway, any recommendations or anything else you want to add?
Let's see. I just thought when you said all this shit is over, I'm like, you know, it's never gonna be over, right? But this is our new reality. Oh, sorry. Sorry, everyone. Spoiler alert, we're fucked. I did get my first dose.
My husband says, like, this is the last season of America.
Girl, it's we're been. I'm like, it. God, can you end the fucking show already? It's like this season of RuPaul's Drag Race, season 13. Oh, my God. Let's get to the end, honey. But I know. Did you get your first dose of the vaccine yet, Babs?
No, I've signed for it, and I'm still waiting. You know, New Mexico is going fast, pero nada. ¿Y tú? ¿A poco ya?
I did. I was able to get it this past weekend, and I still can't believe it that I have it.
That's so exciting.
I know. I'm going to get my second dose March 24th. Oh, no my gosh. Huh?
¿No te dolió?
No. Fucking wimp. No, I'm just kidding. I didn't even feel it.
It was nice.
The nurse was so good. Like, she was just talking to me, like, la, 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 la. And she's like, okay, you're done. So she was such a pro. And it was just, the only thing that happened is I had a little bit of a headache, and my arm where I got the shot was sore just for, like, 12 hours. And that's it.
Oh, that's not bad.
So not bad. I'm over here now trying to convince my family to go get it. One of my grandmas got it already. My other one is a QAnon follower, so I don't know. My Guatemalan 85-year-old grandma is like, they're putting chips in the vaccine, or it's just, I called her yesterday, and it was like, it's just water in there. Me dijo la vecina que no más le ponen agua. And I'm like, grandma. So I just call her every day now, and I'm like, okay, I hear you, but when you're ready to go get it, I'll drive you personally. I'm just leaving the door open, you know, because these fucking people, you can't break them. Anyway, recommendations.
Espérate. No, on that note, my dad, what? Too, like, he's like, yo no me la voy a poner para que la necesito, guara la cuchara. I've had fights with him. And my little sister came in one day to the house and was like, oh, by the way, I already signed you up for the vaccine. You're going to get it tomorrow. And he's like, va, cabrón, pues me la pongo.
Well, that's what we have to do. I know that's how my one of my friends told his mom. I was like, well, if you want to see me and if you want to see the kids, you got to get it. And she's like, all right, I guess I'm going to go get it.
Yeah, but you have to use sentimentality and you have to use kids. When you do that, con los abuelos, no se pueden.
Pizzagate. Okay. Do you have any recommendations?
Yes, I want to recommend a video that just came out, like a mini documentary that just came out from my favorite band, Balloon. It's called Punto de Encuentro, an immersion into Balloon's Prisma Tropical. They actually went to Puerto Rico and they film with Puerto Rican filmmaker and performance artist Gisela Rosario Ramos. And they did this beautiful, beautiful like performance / documentary. Fabi, they've never sound better. Like they have all of these musicians. Like there's like a new depth to the music, and there's snippets in between songs where because they're like in a big hall, and they have lights. They have like people playing, you know, like social distance or whatever. But in the walls, they have pictures of their childhood. Of the members. So they talk about being in Puerto Rico, they talk about Puerto Rico, and they show pictures of themselves. So it's like cada miembro de la banda starts talking about it. It's so beautiful. And the performance was a culmination of a virtual residency, a week-long virtual residency with Brandeis University. And it's amazing. It's amazing. Angelica texted me. He's like, oh, this just came out today. I want you to watch it. It was so, so, so beautiful. Again, you can find the full performance on YouTube. Punto de Encuentro, an immersion into Balloon's Prisma Tropical. Amazing, amazing stuff. No se lo pierdan. So that's my recommendation for today. ¿Y tú?
Sweet. There's a hella landscaping happening, I guess, every Tuesday. Now we know. So you might have to edit the background noise out, Babs.
Okay.
That's what I'm saying. Okay, I'm going to recommend, I think if you guys aren't sick of virtual online events yet, and you haven't gone to a virtual art opening yet, El Museo del Barrio is having the virtual celebration on March 12th at 6 p.m. So go to elmuseo.org and sign up. It's free from 6 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. EST, Eastern Standard Time. I think I'm going to be there. So hopefully see y'all there. Check out the art virtually and say hello to the artists and curators.
Sweet. That sounds awesome. Are you going to talk at all, or is just like...
Girl, you know these museums don't let me talk. Please.
That's funny.
All right. Okay, anything else, Babs?
That's it.
Okay, as always... Oh, my God. The fucking leaf blower is right outside of my garage right now. Literally. Whatever. We're going to go with the flow. We're going to go with the wind. Go with the leaf blower. As always, you can visit us at latinoswhilunch.com. If you have a moment, please leave us a review. 5 stars.
5 estrellas solamente.
Because the more reviews we have, the more visible we are. And
visibility leads to representation, and representation matters.
Today's episode was produced and edited by Justin Favela and Emmanuel Ortega, with production assistance from Maite Sosa. The music you're listening to now is by the band Balloon. It's so loud. I'm Fabi Fav.
And I'm Babelito.
Bye.
Ciao, ciao, ciao.